thanks for joining us for our latest in our Broadstone broadcast series, hosted today by myself, Brett Hill, Head of Health and Protection, and by my colleague, Emily Jones, Client Consulting Director. Today, we're delighted to have as our special guest, Dr. Gordon Wishart, Founder and Chief Medical Officer at Check for Cancer. Check for Cancer are one of the UK's leading providers of cancer screening services, so we're thrilled to have Gordon join us today. Gordon, welcome, and thank you for joining us. Before we get started, I wonder if you could give our listeners some background on why you came to start Check for Cancer and how the company currently delivers its services to customers across the UK.
Yeah, thank you for having me, first of all. So my career was as a breast cancer surgeon and a clinical researcher. And I did a lot of work in the NHS trying to improve things in cancer services. And so a few years ago, I was really interested in trying to ensure that the same kind of clinical governance that we had in the NHS, you know, should be extended into the private sector. There had been the terrible catastrophe in Birmingham with a rogue breast surgeon, Ian Paterson, and I felt the whole of the private sector was getting a bad name because of that. And so I started Check for Cancer mainly to introduce screening to the private sector and make sure that people were having evidence-based and validated tests. And then that extended into managed pathways, mainly for the insured sector. So now we're in a position where we're really focused on early cancer detection. So cancer screening, cancer prevention, risk assessment, and then diagnostics. We don't stray into cancer treatment. We take people up to the point of diagnosis, and then with the consultants that we work with, allow them to stay with those consultants and have the optimal treatment pathway. So it's been a real journey, and you know, it's been a time of great change, both with the pandemic, but also with all the new developments coming through as well. So a challenging time, but a really exciting time.
Yes, and health is very much, I think, increasingly in the public consciousness, especially since the pandemic, but probably going to be increasingly so in the run-up to what is a looming general election at some point in the next 6 to 8 months. So from your perspective, when you look across the sort of the current landscape in the UK, what is the current state of NHS cancer services across diagnostics and treatment?
Well, they're under enormous pressure in a way that they've never been before. And you know, this is not just a post-pandemic phenomenon. We first had cancer targets that were introduced, I think, about 2000. And essentially, we've had an infrastructure that's really not been invested in. And yet during that time, cancer incidence has gone up due to an aging and increasing population. And that same infrastructure has had to cope with an increasing demand. And it was no surprise that many of us wrote in April 2020 that at the end of the pandemic, the NHS would not be able to cope with the surge in activity because of the lockdown that had closed everything down. And that's what we're seeing now. So a system that was under enormous pressure then put under even more pressure. And so we have some of the longest waiting times for cancer diagnosis and treatment. And we only measure cancer waiting times for those people that are referred urgently on an urgent cancer pathway. We think that's probably about 50% of everybody. So although the waiting times look quite long for those people on an urgent pathway, they'll be even longer for people who don't get onto an urgent pathway. And so given that we have one of the worst cancer survival rates amongst developed countries and the worst in the G7, we're starting off from a really low position, and I can't see us improving that in the near future because we just don't detect cancer early enough. And that's the main reason that we're languishing down these league tables. And until that's addressed, we're really just going to be tweaking a few points up or a few points down every month and making no real headway into what is a real disaster, actually, for everybody in this country.
I'd love to get into the detail of some of the reasons why we're struggling. Is it primary care? Is it lack of hospital beds? Is it lack of specialists? But before I do, I think I just want to pick up on something you mentioned there that might be come as a surprise to some readers. You mentioned two different treatment pathways there for cancer, urgent and non-urgent. I think many listeners will be surprised to hear there's such a thing as a non-urgent pathway for cancer. Can you just unpack that a little bit for us?
Sure. So for most of the common cancers, there's an agreed set of referral criteria, maybe 5, 6 or 7 for each cancer, and you'll have it for breast cancer, for bowel cancer. And if you see your GP and then you fulfill one of those criteria, you get onto the urgent pathway. If you've got symptoms, but your GP's not quite certain what they're related to, it could be cancer, it could be something else, then you'll be investigated in a non-urgent way. And so, I mean, the fact that we even have an urgent cancer pathway really is a sign that our NHS services are being rationed. I mean, there's no other way of, you know, explaining that, because if we were in a country like France or Germany, people would go and get investigated quickly, whatever their symptoms. But the fact is, we have these urgent and non-urgent pathways. The sad thing is, even in the urgent pathways now, you're seeing increasingly long waiting times. So that's always been the case ever since cancer became, you know, high on the radar for the NHS in the year 2000. What we're seeing in addition to that now is the inability to see your GP, or maybe not seeing your GP at all, or having a virtual consultation. And virtual consultations are pretty useless for cancer diagnosis. So I think when you add on that wait to see your GP and then the increasing time to be seen and then investigated, it's no surprise that from the first time you experience symptoms till you actually start cancer treatment is getting longer and longer.
I think when you look at NHS spending, without getting into party politics, for the current government would say that NHS spending is at a record high by historical levels. No doubt NHS spending will be a feature of any upcoming general election campaign. To what extent is this just a problem about money that could be solved quickly by money, or to what extent are some of these issues now kind of baked into the system and, you know, underlying capacity issues that are going to take time to resolve?
Yes, well, I think we have an increasingly unhealthy population. So it's no surprise that NHS spend is going up. The trouble is, I think we're being forced to spend it in a reactive way to the ill health of our population, rather than saying we have this money now to invest in cancer. So the reason there isn't any spare money to invest in cancer is it's been spent on, you know, lots of chronic diseases, diabetes, musculoskeletal disorders, cardiac disease. So there's that side of things. Then if we look at the infrastructure, which I was mentioning earlier, I think some of your listeners will be surprised to know that we have, you know, less doctors and nurses per head of population, you know, we're always comparing to developed countries, the rest of Europe, for instance. We have less CT scanners and MRI scanners. I think Japan has about 10 times the number of scanners that we have per head of population. Most of Europe is 2 to 3 times the number we have. And we've got a very outdated IT infrastructure as well. So, and that's really as a result of long-standing lack of investment by all political parties. I don't see this as a political issue. I see this as we just have this really unhealthy population and we haven't invested over a long period of time. So to put things right, even to get us back to where we should be or we could have been, it would be an enormous amount of money. And I think that the stats that brought that into perspective for me was when it was reported that even if we had the same cancer survival as the average for Europe, not the best, the average, that would save 18,000 deaths a year in the UK. And that's really quite a good measure of how far we are behind these comparable countries.
Yeah, that's quite shocking, isn't it?
Yeah, it is shocking.
And I guess listeners will sort of know intuitively that cancer is as a time critical diagnosis, but could you just talk us through, for maybe for some of the more common cancers, what the potential impact is of these delays in diagnosis, these delays in accessing treatment, not just in terms of maybe eventual treatment outcomes and survival rates, but also the patient experience, the complexity, and I guess ultimately the cost, whether it's the NHS paying or whether it's an employer paying through a company-funded healthcare scheme, what the impact is on cost and complexity of treatment.
Yeah. So one of the challenges we've always had is that we have some cancers like breast cancer or skin cancer, where something presents on the outside. You notice a breast lump or you notice a mole that's changed. And so in general, if people are vigilant and they have the right investigations, you tend to pick up those cancers at an earlier stage, which is a good thing. And screening helps pick up some of the common cancers at an even earlier stage before those symptoms arise. But the real challenges we have are with cancers of the internal organs, like bowel cancer, pancreatic cancer, lung cancer, because if we wait for symptoms to arise, then the cancer is usually at a more advanced stage. And for any cancer, when it's at a more advanced stage, it will usually require more complex treatment, as you were alluding to, more time off work, more time away from family. That more complex treatment will often mean more side effects, more prolonged side effects, and a greater delay before you get back to work or your family. And notwithstanding the fact that the more advanced the cancer is, then usually the worse the outcome in terms of survival and life expectancy. And that's why it one of the things that really concerns me is that when people get symptoms, we have to move quickly. We have to investigate people quickly and diagnose them quickly. And that is easier for these more external type cancers than the internal ones. So apart from screening, we're constantly looking at ways to try and, you know, pick up new cancers. But it is a challenge. And, you know, just in melanoma alone, they've looked at the stage at diagnosis since lockdown finished, and there's been a 17% stage shift. So that means that someone, rather than presenting at stage one or two, they're going to two or three or three or four, so more advanced. And that's a sign of the whole system under pressure, not just in the UK, but elsewhere as well. So some of the challenges we're experiencing are peculiar to the NHS and to the UK, but they are happening to some extent in other countries as well. It's just, I think they have more resources to try and cope and mitigate what's happening compared to ourselves.
Thanks, Gordon. We've obviously listened there to a little bit of the bleak stats and stories that we're hearing and the challenges certainly that the NHS are facing. I guess thinking about the future, can you maybe explain to us what we're seeing that's near future ready or current in terms of development that can help overcome some of these challenges, thinking about diagnosis and thinking about more effective treatment plans?
Yeah, I mean, the sad thing is that there are great developments in cancer diagnosis and treatment happening all the time, but unfortunately, they're completely camouflaged by, you know, our great concerns, and we're right to be concerned about the state of our current outcomes. So AI is going to play a greater role, not just in diagnosis, but maybe even in choosing the right type of treatment, the right types of chemotherapy. It's obviously got to be used in the right way, but we have seen quite a number of studies now showing that it is very effective in breast screening. So reporting the screening mammograms, which traditionally have been reported by two independent radiologists. And I think what we'll see more and more is one of those reporters being an AI model. And I think that can be done safely. And there's some evidence that it actually will pick up more of these early cancers than two human reports, which is, so that's really exciting. We've been doing some work at Check for Cancer on building an AI model to help diagnose skin cancer. So we have a very successful teledermatology pathway where people come in quickly, see a nurse, have a history, have the right images taken, and then they're uploaded for reporting. And we're seeing the demand for that pathway. I think it increased 50% from 2022 to 2023. And then if we look at Q1 2023 till Q1 now, it's gone up over 100%. So there's this huge demand and surge for cancer diagnostics. So if we can partly automate the triage process in that pathway or use it as a decision aid, that would help enormously. And so I think we see things like that happening. But AI also has the ability to look at lots of data and work out what the important factors are. So we were looking at clinical data and 23 data points for each of the patient that came through our teledermatology pathway. But AI's brought that right down to 7, the 7 most important ones. You can create a weighted score, and suddenly you've got something else in addition to the images to go into an AI model to say this patient's fine or this patient needs a face-to-face assessment and a possible biopsy. So I think some great things happening with AI. Some new drug treatments that are coming out for breast cancer, which is also good. The problem is a lot of these newer drugs and targeted therapies are the ones that are more costly. And because we're seeing this stage shift to later stage at diagnosis, I think that's one of the reasons we're seeing the increase in cancer claim costs. Some other things are happening, though, that, you know, in medicine, there's a tendency to get stuck in a rut. And, you know, I think when I first became a breast surgeon, most units were giving people radiotherapy to patients over a 5-week period. And we were doing it for 3 weeks in Cambridge. And then one of the good things that happened in the pandemic was they accelerated the results of a study that was just using 1 week of radiotherapy. And now for most breast cancer patients, that is just as good as 3 or 5, but much less side effects. So that's incredibly good. We've seen prostate cancer come down a little bit in terms of radiotherapy, but there's this fantastic oncology unit in Lisbon, which for many patients with prostate cancer can give them 1 dose of radiotherapy. And I know several people that have gone there and had that. So I think one of the things we don't do very well is looking outside our own country, finding what's good, what works well, and bringing it here. There's still that kind of, I don't know, reluctance to accept that somebody else has done all the work. And why don't we just accept that and adopt it? And I think we could do a lot more of that to accelerate the change in our cancer services.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned obviously earlier that different countries are certainly at an advanced level than we are. Is there one particular country that you would say actually are adopting a lot of new methods and AI strategies to combat the risk of cancer?
No, I wouldn't pick out anyone in particular. No. I think there's always great research going on in most countries. And I know that, you know, we have relied heavily on that in the UK, and we've relied on, you know, charities like Cancer Research UK, you know, Prostate Cancer UK. And we know that there's a big challenge now for funding, and a lot of the funding that has traditionally fed through to help people like me do research degrees and run research studies, a lot of that has fallen away. And that's really worrying for future generations, because, you know, what we're doing today and how we're treating people today is based on studies that have been done in the last 10 to 20 years.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's fantastic to hear of the new developments. I guess for a lot of our listeners who will be funding their own private healthcare, whether it's by trust or insured arrangements, I mean, what do you think are going to be the challenges for them? Obviously, the cost of treatment will be escalating. How do they manage this?
I think that's a real challenge, and I'm not sure I have all the answers to that, because, you know, there was a bit of downtime for the PMI companies during lockdown, so that post lockdown they tended to freeze their costs, but now, you know, We've got rising claims, rising number of people having claims. And I think it's going to take a kind of multifaceted approach by companies to try and manage that whole process. I think we might see a move or a greater move towards different tiers of PMI, different layers of cover. I know we've had that traditionally, but I suspect it's going to be used more and more. And, you know, there might be stricter rules about who can access these really expensive payments and what do the indications need to be that allow you to have that kind of treatment. You know, if something's going to extend your life for 4 or 6 months, is can that be justified? And it all comes back to kind of value-based healthcare, you know, outcome per unit of cost. And we've been doing a lot of work with some payers and providers and the Health Value Alliance trying to define what an optimal cancer pathway is and how you measure it and how we can encourage, you know, more and more people to adopt these more sustainable, better value cancer pathways, because it can be done. There's a lot of wastage in the system. You know, a lot of people have multiple appointments to have 2 or 3 investigations, and that's spread out over a period of time. And in the private sector, that might mean repeat consultations to discuss the results. Whereas, you know, we've shown that by designing cancer diagnostic pathways that are patient-centered and patient-focused, they're a win-win for everybody, particularly the patient, but they're also cheaper for the insurance company as well. So that just traditional way of, you know, consultants being in charge of, you know, what investigations and how it's done, I think there'll be a move away from that and more of a, the term managed care has a kind of bad, you know, connotation, but actually if it's managed for the best way for the patient, then that's a good thing, because it will be good for everybody else as a follow on.
The critical distinction there is in managed care is on what basis is are those management decisions taken, and if it's managed care based on clinical evidence, clinical efficacy, what is the most effective treatment, what is the most appropriate treatment, rather than management based on what is the cheapest treatment, then actually if you get the most effective treatment, the most appropriate treatment first time, that individual piece of treatment might be relatively expensive, but if it's done right first time, then the overall course of treatment could be ultimately much cheaper than having to, you know, go around the houses as you describe and have 2, 3, 4 consultations before you get to the right diagnosis, the right treatment pathway.
Absolutely. So I think, you know, we might see insurers working with smaller groups of consultants, consultants who can deliver a set standard, you know, for particular pathways. You know, that's what we've provided to the insurers. We maybe work with about 80 breast surgeons who can deliver a true one-stop service where all your investigations are done at that first visit. But there are probably about 300 or 400 breast surgeons working privately in the UK. So at what point does an insurer say, if you want to keep your premium at this level, then we would like you to go into this pathway, because we know it's evidence-based, we know it's patient-focused, and we know it's less costly, but you will get the best treatment in it. Whereas if you move outside of that managed pathway, it's quite hard to tell what's going on, because there's no onus on the insurer to audit those consultants or the hospital providers. And so it's only if you have a pathway that's set up to be audited that you can give that clinical feedback and outcomes to the insurer. And I think we'll see more of that going forward.
And just in terms of innovations, I know you've mentioned a few and we've referred to AI. Is there anything in particular that you would say, thinking about, you know, early detection, accurate diagnosis, cost-effective treatment plans, what are the key ones that you would say for the future that are going to help and manage those strategies?
Yeah, I think a key part of any workforce cancer strategy has to be focusing on the earlier part of the cancer pathway. So it's very easy to just get caught up thinking, how are we going to pay for all these expensive treatments? But actually, if we think of focusing on looking at the cancer risk profile of your employee population, by doing risk assessments, by doing education so that people are aware of the signs and the symptoms of cancer, so they're ready to get investigated as soon as they notice something, and trying to mitigate some of their own risk factors. You know, we know what the main risk factors are that are driving most of the common cancers. It's, you know, obesity, smoking, alcohol, poor diet. And so we probably need to pass on some of that responsibility to employees to look after their own health. I think we've become a bit of a nanny state in the UK, and I think lockdown accentuated that. So we know that by investing in screening for your employees, you, over a 5 to 10 year period, you will usually save money, that you will usually get a return on your investment. And we've built a model that can show that. You look at a company's demographics, and with just 6 or 7 pieces of information, you can look at what the relative ROI is. And I think that's where we've really got to focus. And I know that's difficult when everybody's going to be worried about the rising costs of PMI, but actually to take a step back and think, looking over the next 5 years, which is difficult, I know, for insurers, because they tend to just think about this year, this financial year. But at some point, we've got to look further ahead than that, I think, if we're going to all help each other get out of this challenge.
It's an interesting one, Matt, because I think prevention is often probably the unsexy part of the cancer discussion.
Mm.
Because, you know, employers maybe intuitively don't want to be seen to be wagging a finger at their employees, telling them what to eat, telling them how to live their lives. But as you say, cancer incidence rates are on the rise, and part of that is an aging population, but part of it is a population whose health risk profile is worsening for lots of reasons. Could you give employers an idea, a rough idea, what kind of impact they could potentially have over cancer incidence rates over a 5-year period if they were to really put the shoulder behind the wheel on some of that well-being piece, some of that healthy lifestyle encouragement?
We've got a good idea of what percentage of the common cancers are preventable. You know, so it's about 23% of breast cancer is preventable. So this is usually by, you know, modifying lifestyle behaviour. You can't do anything about your genes and your family history. You know, you're stuck with that. About 50% of bowel cancer is preventable. That's largely being driven by alcohol and obesity, poor diet, and lack of exercise. So but that's the opportunity, you know, 50%. And it's not just the elderly. We know that cancer is increasing in the under 50s as well. Nothing like the same as the older population, you know, where it's got a much higher incidence. But it's definitely increasing, and we're getting more and more reports of young people with quite advanced bowel cancer. Now, obviously, we need to see some statistics on that, but that's really worrying. And so I think if we see the opportunity as, you know, almost a quarter of breast cancer, half of bowel cancer, you know, a huge percentage of lung cancer. So that's the opportunity. And it may be that we get to the point where, you know, employers are saying, we'd like you to fill out this risk questionnaire. And if you are at risk because of some lifestyle risk factors, we want to help you tackle those. Vitality have done a great job of encouraging people to have exercise. And when you look at their data from South Africa and you know, look at the relationship between the amount of exercise and your life expectancy, it's you know, when you see that, you think, well, why aren't we all doing that? You know, it's a kind of no-brainer, but they've got the data to prove that. And we need to harness some of that. And I think it may be that if you want to have private medical insurance in this company, then we want you to also do this as well. I think that's maybe where we're going to head is one of the key parts of a strategy.
Brilliant. Yeah, thank you, Gordon. I mean, some really interesting stats and information and guidance in there. Really appreciate it. I think for the listeners, the focus for them and certainly in conjunction with us is to look at their healthcare strategy, look to the future, think about measures that they can put in place. But I think that leads us nicely onto probably the next podcast.
Yeah, very much so. I think there's a there's a whole other discussion there around treatment pathways, managing rising costs of claims and strategies to get in front of that. And as you say, Gordon, I think the hard reality of some of the increases that we're seeing come through in the healthcare sector now in funding are probably going to prompt some employers to face into some of these questions that have been around for a while, but maybe not made their way to the top of the agenda yet. I think they're going to, if they're not there now, they're going to be getting there pretty soon, as everybody tries to get to grips with this challenge. So, look, fascinating subject, much more to discuss. Hopefully you'll join us again some future date.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Emily, thanks for joining me today as well, and thanks to our listeners, and we'll see you at some point, or you'll hear us at some point on the next broadcast. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.